Good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grodi, here on EWTN. And once again, we have this great privilege to come together to share a story of faith and conversion. We're joined tonight by Jennifer Bryson. She's a former Lutheran and evangelical. And, you know, there's a whole, as we always say, there's so much, you know, that you can't really describe in a lower third. Lots of ground to cover tonight in her amazing story. If you want to know more about her, later we'll share more about her website. It's jenniferbryson.net, but she entered the church in 1990, and we're really honored to have her here tonight to share her story. Jennifer, thanks for being here. I'm not going to shake your hand because you hurt your hand. You told me beforehand. It's so great to have you here.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. We have a lot of ground to cover. You've had an interesting and storied life, you know, in so many ways, but let's go back to the beginning and tell us a little bit about where you grew up and your upbringing, your faith background.
I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and my mother took us, me, my two older brothers and me, to a Lutheran church growing up.
Okay.
My father wasn't interested, although in the early part of my childhood, he always went along. But that meant that church was mostly just some place we went to on Sundays. Other than grace at meals, it didn't really play a role at home. And I got in trouble in Sunday school early on. And this is really like early elementary school, or maybe it was about fifth grade or so, but it was still elementary school, yeah, for asking questions. And that, the teacher's response left a big impression on me. And the example I remember so vividly, I could take you to the room where this happened today, was that we were studying and learning about Adam and Eve in the garden. And I really liked science and learning as a child, so I would watch the science TV show Nova. And I had seen a show about the Middle East and Mesopotamia. And so I raised my hand and I asked, I said, well, I heard that apples don't grow in that part of the world because of the climate. Couldn't it have been a pomegranate? And for me, this was just an honest question because, right, I was interested in, you know, the world.
Yeah.
And she said, just stop asking questions. And so I thought, well, this is really stupid. Mm. And my childish view, you know, well, religion is a stupid thing for stupid people. And I only had older brothers, as I mentioned. So also I'm getting their teenage influence of this stupid, we don't want anything to do with it. And so I was really turned off. But thanks to my mom, we kept going to church. Also, my church was at the edge of a very long town, which meant that those who attended were from my town and the next town over. So I had childhood friends who were not in our school system. And so church was the place I got to see those friends. So mostly with my mother's influence, we kept going. And then it came to the point of confirmation, which was in early high school for us. And, you know, by high school, teenager, things are getting more and more tense with me in the church and, you know, parent-teenager things at home. And I didn't believe some of the things that we were being taught. And I went to my mom and I said, I don't believe this. And my mother at that point, who was not pushy, but she said, just this one thing. Please, just do this one thing. And I felt like I'm being asked to lie. Mm. But it was really important to her. And so I said, all right, I'll go along with it. But at the ceremony, I remember that we said the creed together as a group. And so there were certain parts of the creed I didn't say because I knew, I remember, like, born of a Virgin Mary. I was like, oh, I don't believe that's true. So I just didn't say that part so that I wouldn't be lying. Mm-hmm. So that was my confirmation experience, which, yeah, wasn't very good. Fortunately, in high school, we had a fantastic youth pastor who came at that time. He was doing his PhD in theology at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. And here was somebody who wasn't getting mad at me if I asked questions. Instead, he was assigning us questions to choose to go answer and do presentations for our group. Wow. And I could have conversations with him. And I thought, this is amazing. And also there was just something peaceful, joyful, and solid in his life. And he and his wife had a good marriage at a time when I'm starting to watch friends' parents get, sure, divorced. And I thought, someday I knew I have to figure out what's going on in his life. And I laugh today that back then it didn't occur to me, but this is my teenage, you know, child viewpoint, that, well, maybe this thing going on in his life has to do with the fact that he's a pastor and a Christian. But I just knew there's something really good there. I got to figure that out someday.
Yeah.
But as I said, I was really turned off to religion. Mm-hmm. So this is stupid. So I finished high school. Before I finished high school, my junior year of high school, I was a foreign exchange student in Austria. And so I lived there for the whole year and attended a college prep, sort of high school equivalent, right, in Austria. And there were just a few things that year that left a deep impression on me. By this point, I'm already somewhat anti-Catholic. I'm not sure where that had come from, but I had Catholics to me. I knew some growing up, and they actually did go to church. I noticed that. I had a friend, if we had a play date on Saturday night, you know, her family would go to Mass first before I could come over. But it was negative in my view. So, and I was in a rural area of Austria. It was all Catholic. So I arrive in Austria. It's just a few weeks after my 15th birthday. I've just turned 16. I'm very young. And my host family that I lived with told me, well, we're going on a trip tomorrow, and we didn't know if you'd want to come, but we bought you a ticket. But you don't have to go, because they knew I wasn't Catholic. Mm-hmm. They said, tomorrow morning, we're getting up, like it was like 3 or 4 in the morning, to take a train to Vienna for an outdoor mass with Pope John Paul II.
Whoa.
This was a 1983 mass he gave outdoors in Vienna. And I was a curious and venturesome young person. So I said, sure. So I went along that day. And I have two memories. One is they were handing out to people metal crucifixes that were like the crucifix that Pope John Paul II held. And I was horrified. Hmm. I didn't tell anyone.
Yeah.
You know, they were my hosts. This was my first day there. But I was like, I was used to seeing the cross blank.
Right.
So it was really upsetting for reasons I don't know. I kept that for many years, even as I moved around, and I have it today in my house.
Wow.
And the second thing was that the service, because it was a Novus Ordo service, which is more like the Protestant services in a lot of ways, was, I thought, oh, well, they sing songs. You know, this isn't that different. And I had been to a mass before middle school when a cousin got married. But it wasn't as exotic or alienating as I might have expected.
Sure.
But it wasn't, well, I'm not Catholic. So the year went on, and I never went to Mass with the families. I always had to stay home alone on Sundays, which I thought was a little odd, but I guess they felt they shouldn't evangelize. Mm. At Christmas, a host family I was with took me to Mass, but it was, you know, the midnight Mass. It was dark, it was night, and I remember thinking it was like a funeral, because it was just so different, mm-hmm, than what I knew. So that was another like, and then at the very end of the year, my host brother, who at my last family was older, was 34 years old, 34, wanted to take me on a trip to Rome before I left Europe. He said to me, you've got to see civilization before you go back to, you know, America, where there's no civilization, was the implication. So it was incredibly kind of him.
Yeah.
He took me to Rome.
Wow.
And we went to St. Peter's and went into the church, and off to the side, I saw a woman kissing the feet of a statue, and I said, see, Catholics are pagans. I knew it. It made me more anti-Catholic. So I went back, finished high school, went off to college. I went to Stanford, and I had no religion at that point.
Okay.
I hadn't thought about what religion I would be. I just knew I wanted nothing to do with this. I thought, I don't need this anymore. This young, naive, ridiculous view of like, well, the smart people don't do religion. So went through my freshman year of college. Mm-hmm. And having had this great overseas experience in high school, I wanted to go overseas during college. And I wanted to go overseas to enroll directly in a foreign university. It's wonderful that there are overseas programs where Americans can go and they have American-taught classes with others in English. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people go overseas that they wouldn't otherwise get that experience. But I just knew, having learned German when I was young, I wanted to enroll and be like in the foreign setting.
Yeah.
So I narrowed it down to two places that would be really different. I thought, Western Europe, been there, done that, which is a silly, childish view, but that's how I felt after high school. So I thought, well, I could go to Togo in West Africa, because UC Santa Cruz had a program there, and I'd had French. Or I could go to East Germany, communist East Germany. I thought, oh, that would be interesting. Oh, that would be really different. Mm-hmm. Of course, I was very naive and adventuresome. And so I looked into this, and it just so happened at the same time that the East German government had come up with a new program to invite five Americans to East Germany for a year on scholarships. And they offered these scholarships to universities where the government had personal relationships, and one was Stanford. And so for my sophomore year of college, I got a scholarship from the communist East German government. This was 86, 87.
Wow.
To go study in East Germany. And I went to Leipzig, which is south of Berlin, and I enrolled in the Karl Marx University. And I lived in a dorm with foreign students from mm-hmm. all over the Soviet-influenced world. So from the Soviet Union, we had Russians and Uzbeks and Tajiks, etc. We had students from the Republic of Georgia, from North Korea, Vietnam, ANC, as African National Congress. That was the communist movement in South Africa. We had Sandinistas from Nicaragua. That was the communist movement in Nicaragua. And early on, at the very beginning, before the classes really got going, a student asked me at a social event, are you Marxist?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, I don't know. I don't know enough to be able to say yes, but I also don't know enough to be able to say, no, I'm not. And I thought, well, this seems like an important question here, because like everything's based on this.
Right.
And so for my studies that year, I chose to enroll in the Marxism-Leninism program. And the university required six semesters, so three full years sequentially, of Marxism-Leninism for all students doing an undergraduate degree. And I got permission to take all at once, but the sequence of them is very important for their system and for my story.
Mm-hmm.
So the first year was a year of philosophy, and you were required to have a year of philosophy before you could study economics, and certainly before you could study politics, because it was not an economic system.
Mm-hmm.
This was a philosophy. This was a whole worldview. And yes. economics were only an afterthought,
right.
a consequence of what they thought existence was.
Right.
So I enrolled, and in the philosophy course, it was a small seminar. And fortunately, I had a fantastic professor who was a true believer in Marxism-Leninism, and he was a wonderful teacher, instructor. And I remember on the first day of class, he told us that the point of this course for the year was to figure out what is true about existence. And I had never in my entire life had that question introduced into education.
Yeah.
I knew how to study for the test. I, you know, had a, where I grew up, secular education, secular environment, largely secular at home, 1970s, you know, feminism was assumed in the Bay Area. A little girl was told, life is your career, career and beating the boys. I didn't know anything else. Even when I went to Stanford, I was in one of the last classes to have the Great Books program, mm-hmm. fortunately. And I had a sense in the Great Books program at Stanford that there were some ideas that I liked and some that I was kind of... But the Great Books program was really, truly open-minded and wanted to expose us to great thinkers who disagreed even with each other.
Right.
And that was okay.
Yeah.
But I didn't have any notion of to ask, well, is this true or is this not true? So this rocked my world.
Yeah.
And it also made me more curious about what I had enrolled in. I was like, this matters. And so the philosophy course started out by studying, it was a course in materialist philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that physical matter is the primary thing of existence, and anything that is abstract or an idea or ideal only comes afterwards as a response to physical matter.
Right.
So we started out by studying ancient Greek philosophers who were early materialists, mm-hmm. Democritus and Anaximander, who focused on the physical elements, some of them such as fire, air, water, and that was the foundation. And it was also, I think, to emphasize to us that materialism is something that humans have been attracted to from very early on, not just made up lately.
Right.
And then, and looking back on this, especially as a Catholic, this is sort of the funny part, we skipped from there to Feuerbach because nothing happened in philosophy in between. So no Aristotle, no Plato, yeah. No Thomas Aquinas, mm-hmm. Not even Hegel. He was too idealistic for them.
Yeah.
And then the course focused sequentially, and fortunately we read a lot of primary source texts, Feuerbach, Marx, Engels, and Lenin. Mm. And it was in historical and dialectical materialism, so we're studying how history unfolds and the role of matter in the dialectical way of exploring existence.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, the course didn't talk about or mention atheism until that was in our curriculum. I don't know. I want to say maybe like 6 to 8 weeks in. I have my notebooks. I need to go back and look at them and see if I can find this date. And this was really interesting because atheism was just simply assumed. But what they'd really done is given us the whole groundwork and the primer so that by the time they introduce atheism, it's just obvious. And by this point, I'm feeling the like the temperature starting to heat up. I'm going to have to like figure out if this is true or not. I was even a bit upset. Like, here's this whole explanation about existence. Why hasn't anyone told me about this before?
Right.
Because if this is true, this matters. Mm-hmm. So I was also studying even more intensely. I always work very hard to prepare for this class because I thought, well, this is important. And I was fascinated. It was completely new to me.
Yeah.
We were assigned to read an essay by Lenin that we were going to discuss on why you can't have Marxism and Marxism-Leninism, as they called it, without atheism.
Interesting.
And so I was in the reading room of the Karl Marx University with rows of table and students. And it was a reference room, so I was surrounded by the collected works in multi-volume sets of Marx, Engels, and Lenin, multiple copies of them, so make sure everybody had access. And I'm reading this essay, and at this point, I'm not asking the question of, well, atheism or God. I simply God wasn't even on my radar. It was, this might really be true. It was like I was going forward towards a cliff with a dark abyss, and the only thing in my sight was that abyss, that like, well, that's where I'm supposed to go. Of course, I didn't view it as an abyss at the time, but I was really going to have to make a decision. And I'm reading, trying to understand the essay, and in one moment, all of a sudden, I had an experience of God. All I can say is God broke into my life, because I'm getting chills remembering this. I wasn't questioning God, thinking about it. I was listening to Lenin explain why atheism is a sine qua non. You have to have it. And that moment, it wasn't a rational thought process at the bottom of a syllogism. It was an experience, and it was right. Of God as my creator.
Yeah.
And God is creator, and we're created. I had a sense of just peace and ease, obviously utter, total, complete awe. And interestingly to me, and it makes sense now that I understand where this experience led, I wanted to turn around to the other students in the room and say, and talk to them, shake them, even say loudly, you don't have to be miserable. God exists. But I didn't. You know, I was the American there that was already a bit tense.
Yeah, yeah.
And the experience was a little overwhelming. I remember there were windows. I could see the sky and the sun. And so walking home that day from the library, I saw the sky and trees and simple things, but in completely new way. God created the sky, the tree. God created that. God created me. And so that was the turning point in my life that I've never looked back
incredible.
From. And this was, I don't know, but I wonder sometimes if God realized I was maybe so hard-headed that God needed to put me into a situation that would really shock me.
Well, it is interesting because like with something like materialism, right, people get, moderns who haven't really dug into it, get very excited about that. But the thing with materialism, right, is that it takes just as much faith as anything else. Because how can you get back behind it to prove it? And so God gives you this experience of, you know, that, well, this is what is the counter to that, right? Yeah. There is something else other than, yeah.
And because this was an experience of God as creator,
right.
It was, oh, well, this is where matter comes from.
Yeah.
God made this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that changed my life.
Wow.
But this was
wow.
still pretty early in my year in East Germany, so I still had months ahead.
Yeah. That's just wild.
And that year, God sent me what I can only describe in a way as almost like little angels to accompany me that year. And these were the Polish students. So from, as I mentioned, I live in a foreign student dorm. There were foreign students from all over the world, Asia, Africa, South America, who had scholarships to spend 5 years in East Germany doing their undergraduate degree. They had a year of German as a foreign language and 4 years of their degree. And so there were a lot of foreign students. And because Poland was right nearby, there were also quite a few Poles. And right from when I got there, the Poles were my friends. And they were also the only students sort of crazy enough. Well, there's other students, some were a little afraid of me, like the North Koreans, who were always in groups, who I think were being afraid of being seen with me or talking to me. Some students kind of avoided me. Some would be very polite. The Polish students sought me out. They loved America. And this was the era of Reagan. Mm. And the Polish students who sought me out and became my friends, especially one student in particular, were very devout Catholics. There were a few Polish students who wanted to party, who weren't real religious, but the Poles, most of them were devout believers, and they were fearless. They talked about their faith, they went to church activities, and they were joyful. There wasn't a lot of joy in East Germany. So where there's that spark of light from joy in a dark setting, it's really bright.
Yeah.
But there was a problem. They were Catholic. And I really did not like Catholics, did not like the Catholic Church. I'd had that experience I told you about at St. Peter's in Rome. And I thought, well, Catholics are pagans. I also have this impression that, well, where there are Catholic populations, there's only like just a bunch of old ladies in church. This is like a stale old thing.
Yeah.
That was just my youthful view. But these were wonderful people. They were wonderful friends. And this was a scary, difficult experience for me in a lot of ways that we won't have time to go into. So having these friends was really wonderful. And then when I had this experience weeks later, I intuitively knew that what I had experienced and what was going on in their lives was the same thing, but they were Catholic.
Yeah.
So the Jesus thing didn't come into the picture, but I'm experiencing and growing in this experience of God in this context in which I have these beautiful, wonderful Polish friends.
Yeah.
So a couple more months go by, and one evening in the winter, it occurred to me I could talk to God. So I decided to try that, and I discovered prayer. And not only prayer, but this really blew me away. I discovered freedom because I realized instantly this is the only thing the East German government couldn't take away from me. Mm. Well, I had my blue American passport, and I had a single exit visa in that passport, which others didn't have. They couldn't leave. In an event of an emergency, I could leave if I had to. But like Leipzig is a very important setting militarily. And so instead of just East German police, there were also a lot of soldiers there from the Soviet Union who were armed. When I went to Berlin, for the first months there until I got my visa changed, because they only gave me a single entry, which I used coming in, and a single exit. In East Berlin, I could only experience the Berlin Wall from the eastern side, and I couldn't go to the west. the barbed wire, the armed guards. I went to visit a cousin at Christmas. I got permission to an American who lived in West Germany, and taking the train over that border. Again, the guards, the weapons, that sense of crossing into a place where the pressure came off. So it was in this high pressure, scary environment where I realized in God, in faith, I'm free. And this is an American from the land of freedom.
Yeah.
Experiencing true deep freedom in East Germany. Mm-hmm. So that was another, huh. I finished the year, came back to the U.S., and I had not figured out the Jesus thing. Mm-hmm. However, in East Germany, in a corner of a used bookstore, in a back room, the back corner of a back room, they had a few books in English. And I don't know if this is a God thing or what, but there was a copy of a book that this great youth pastor had told us about by an author I knew of because I loved the Chronicles of Narnia as a child.
Yeah.
And the book wasn't just any C.S. Lewis book. It was Mere Christianity in English.
Wow.
I have that book today.
You would have thought that would have been verboten.
Yeah, and banned. However, the German government tried, the East German communist government tried to sort of pretend tolerate Christians to prevent a rebellion.
Sure, sure.
Maybe because it was in English? Who knows? And also, I really wonder how did that book get there,
because
it was probably smuggled in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was like, oh, this is that author, you know, Pastor Bill always talked about. And I respected Pastor Bill so much.
Yeah.
So I bought it. I read it. The first section is on whether God exists. I loved it. Yes, yes, yes. This is what I've experienced. He's explaining what I experienced. Section two is the implications of God existing. Is there morality, right or wrong in the world? Yes. Oh, my gosh. This is making, yes. Section three is more on Jesus. No. Why do you have to make it so complicated? I don't see the point. So that's where I was at.
Sure.
And when I come back to the U.S., this is the summer before my junior year of college, the summer of 1987, I was so hungry to meet others who knew God. I was excited. And in America, this should be pretty easy. Here we're free. Here we can talk about it out loud. And so on a Sunday, I thought, well, where else would you go to find people who know God but church? So I drove to the church my mother took us to growing up. At this point, my family no longer had any connection to the church. But, you know, it seemed the obvious place to go. And also, this was the very first time that instead of me complaining and my mother saying, come on, you've got to go, it was me choosing to go by my own will. And it was also amazing to me after East Germany that a group of citizens could purchase private land, and they had the freedom to do on that land what they wanted. If they wanted to build a church, they could. So I really respected that, was excited about this, went to the service. And this was a pretty liberal Lutheran church that at that point was already fading. I talked to the pastor about this experience I just had in East Germany. He could not have been less interested.
Mm.
And so I thought, I'm not in the right place. Summer goes by, I went back to college, a junior at Stanford now, and I really wanted to find students who knew God. I mean, if I can find students who knew God in East Germany, there had to be a few somewhere at Stanford. But I couldn't, how do I find them? I this sounds, you know, some might wonder in retrospect how this was so hard, but I had literally no idea where to go. And it was not a popular topic to talk about at Stanford.
Yeah, yeah. Let's take a little break there.
Okay.
And we'll come back and see who you found.
All right.
What happened next.
Great.
We'll be back in just a couple minutes. Please stay tuned. We'll hear the rest of Jennifer's story. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour speaking. Tonight, speaking with Jennifer Bryson. She's a former Lutheran and evangelical. And Jennifer, gosh, the first half of this episode,
sort of a wild ride. East Germany at the Marx School, studying materialism and atheism and having this experience of God as creator. Wow. Okay. So when we left off, though, you're back in the States and you're looking for people who know God to talk about this with. What happened next?
So I was a junior at Stanford at this point. And something that really changed in my life from East Germany, and this is going to get directly related to my faith story, was it made me appreciate the West and appreciate America. And I felt I had this civic duty to contribute somehow to this because I had just been studying with people who were learning systematically how to destroy our government society. And so I got involved in politics. And, you know, for months on campus, I couldn't figure out. I would walk around campus looking at students wondering, is there somebody here who knows God? But I just, you don't just walk, especially at Stanford, you know, at that time, you just don't walk up to people and ask. So the year went on, and by Easter that year, I thought, okay, I'm going to have to take some initiative to find these people who know God. I'm going to go to an Easter service. And because we went to Lutheran church growing up, because my mother was part Finnish, so it was that Lutheran connection. Yeah. It just seemed like, well, that's where you go to church, is at the Lutheran church. So I went to Easter Sunday service at the Lutheran church on campus. And keep in mind, I have so much hope that I'm going to find people there who know God. Mm-hmm. And I'd been feeling pretty isolated in this regard. And I was still, I would write sometimes with my friends, Polish friends in East Germany, and we'd kept in touch. And I had such fond memories of these joyful, intellectually sharp Catholics. So I go to the Easter service, and the sermon on Easter Sunday, when I'm there so hungry for God, was about the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. They were the communist movement, and why we must support the Sandinistas. Now, you may hear almost laughter coming up in my voice, because I had just been studying Marxism-Leninism with Sandinistas in East Germany. And we learned not only the philosophical foundations of materialist philosophy, then how the economic system needs to be based on physical matter, not, you know, the human person. Yeah. And then the political implications of this. We actually learned how to form communist parties in countries where it's illegal. We even learned about the use of violence in revolution to overthrow governments. And this was Easter Sunday. And I thought, I'm in the wrong place. That was so clear to me that I just went home alone after that. Yeah. But because I had gotten involved in politics on campus through college Republicans, I met this very nice young man. And we started dating, and he was a very devout evangelical Christian. I was really blessed, because on a secular campus like that, there can be a lot of bad stuff going on. Yeah. Young men who aren't exactly angels, and girls getting involved, who knows what. And he was such a pious, morally upright, kind young man. So he took me one evening to something called InterVarsity. It was InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, the evangelical ministry on campus. And I was glad that it was a dark room, because they were showing a slideshow, because I think I was crying. I felt like, okay, I found people who know God here. Yeah. I'd landed, at least for the time. So I kept seeing him. I loved going to church with him. He knew the Bible really well, and he took it seriously. And I didn't realize how much of my liberal, vaguely Lutheran background had influenced me because I thought all the stories were either silly or, well, it's just symbolic, or, well, they just did that because the culture, we don't have to take it seriously. I remember we talked about the Red Sea parting. And, you know, I explained it away from something I'd heard from someone. Oh, maybe it was just a reed, C-R-E-E-D, you know, and maybe the tide was just going out. And to him, he was like, no, this is, God is able to part a sea. Like, God is real, God is powerful, and the Bible is God's word here. So that also was a new thing for me. There were two tensions in our relationship. One was the Jesus question, although I knew I was in the right place with Christians.
Yeah.
Because my Polish friends and now these wonderful evangelicals I was meeting, I knew that God and their faith, this is in the same realm. But so I didn't push back a lot on the Jesus thing, but it was uncomfortable.
Right.
Although he, like, this was important. And so we kept going to church. The other issue was abortion. Hmm. He was strongly pro-life. And I was strongly pro-abortion. As I mentioned, I came from a background where I was raised to education is for your career. And what you're supposed to do as a young woman is break glass ceilings and pursue a career. And to me, entering college and my first freshman year at Stanford, the greatest threat there could be to me as a woman was to get pregnant. This mindset had made me afraid even of my own body. And so, well, I'd have to have abortion available if I ever got pregnant. I wasn't in a situation where that was going to happen, but he didn't just hold the line. There was a line, period. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't understand why in this really nice budding relationship, this was so important to him. His name was Norm. And it was, though, and it became more and more tense. And it was also really important for him, if he were going to continue dating someone, that she understood that abortion is really grave evil. So I left for the summer between my junior and senior year of college. Mm-hmm. I was a State Department intern at our embassy at the time, which in Germany, which is in Bonn, Germany. Wonderful summer there. And I kept going to church. And through that, I met a missionary from the Navigators, who was a missionary to diplomats, the diplomatic circles and families, and who had a wonderful sort of study group in his home, a fellowship time for young people. We were mostly around college, 20-something. And he was really solid and good. And I really respected him. And again, I know that I'm at home when I'm with the Christians. But I'm not saying anything about how this whole Jesus thing is still a little like, why make it so complicated? But that summer, there wasn't a single moment like there was with God. But there was an opening of my heart that summer by God's grace that I figured Jesus out. That Jesus is the center of all this. And that brought with it a 180-degree change in my view of abortion. And I realized this child in the womb is something God created. And also God created my body as a woman, that is as a body that, you know, could in right relationship become pregnant and bear a child. And so my senior year of college at Stanford, I got involved in the pro-life group.
Wow.
It was a small group on the Stanford campus, but it was there and it was strong. And that's where I started to meet Catholics. So my senior year of college goes by. Yeah. My relationship with Norm didn't continue, but I'm grateful for him being a guidepost along the way.
Yeah.
And after my senior year of college, I went to Washington, D.C. for the summer. And I was what they called a legislative fellow, which really glorified internship in the Senate for a senator on foreign affairs and armed services. With my overseas experience, I was interested in international relations. I'd major in political science. I'd wanted to major in philosophy after my experience at the Karl Marx University. Yeah. I loved philosophy, but I realized at Stanford they didn't have, I wanted to ask deep, real questions, whereas it was modern stuff, what you call symbolic systems, language, computer stuff. So,
yeah.
Major in political science, Washington, went off to Washington, D.C., and through a political kind of pro-life connection at a meeting. I met a young woman named Kathy Deeds, who would later become my sponsor. No spoilers, but on this show, I think people know where this is going. Yeah. And started spending time with her and her social circles. And it was this social circle of young Catholics in Washington, D.C., who had been to a variety of solid Catholic schools. And these young Catholics were so, again, so nice. Also, they were so balanced. The young men and young women treated each other well, without being afraid of each other or without being inappropriate. It was, and also with alcohol, they were at ease. They weren't afraid of it, but there were, people weren't getting drunk. It was just a great environment, getting to know more and more people. And one young man in the group named Joe Cirkovich invited me to do sidewalk counseling with him at an abortion clinic. Wow. And this would be every morning on Saturdays at 8 a.m. Now, I was having a blast as a young person in Washington, D.C. on Friday and Saturday nights. Getting up early Saturday morning didn't excite me, but I thought, this is important. So every Saturday morning, 8 a.m., we'd go out there for a few hours in front of a Planned Parenthood clinic in the District of Columbia. And he had information about alternative resources for women. And also there was sometimes another friend of his, so the prayer was also part of this. And because his friend who would sometimes come was Catholic, because there were two of them and one of me and I was the guest, when they wanted to pray the rosary, even though I thought, oh, this is going to be weird Marian stuff, you know, that's what they did. Mm-hmm. But they were, these were meditations on the Bible mostly. So I thought, oh, okay, this isn't that bad. And then in between when women would come and, you know, be available to them as a resource if they wanted and times of prayer, my friend would talk to me, and he was very well formed in his Catholic faith and a very devout Catholic. And he was a member of a group called Opus Dei. And so he knew his faith. He knew the Bible. He loved the Bible. And so unlike other Catholics who, you know, couldn't answer my questions or thought it, there was something wrong with the fact I loved the Bible, for him, this was great. But then he started pushing and asking me questions and challenging my evangelical assumptions, because I was in mostly evangelical circles at this point, considered myself an evangelical. And so he, you know, asked a question that I'm sure has been discussed here at this table many times. Yeah. Well, where does the Bible come from? And I was young and pretty new Christian. I just had never thought about it.
Right.
And that, so that was one thing that was like, oh, hmm. So we talked about that. And one day out there in front of the Planned Parenthood clinic, of all places, he talked to me about John chapter 6 on the Eucharist. This is my flesh. This is my blood. And I realized, I'm in trouble. Hmm. Because spending all this time with Catholics was not an issue for me, because I knew I could never become Catholic. I didn't like Catholics. I didn't like the Catholic Church. So spending time with them was like, fine, whatever. They were nice people. But at this point, I realized if I love the Bible, I'm going to have to become Catholic. If I'm going to follow the Bible, I'm going to have to become a Catholic. So at that point, my questions and my inquiries started to get much more serious, and my heart really opened. So I spent the rest of the summer with these Catholics in D.C., and that fall, so this would have been September 1989, I went to Yale to do a master's degree in history, and I had planned to study modern European diplomatic history because I thought that would be useful for a career, mm-hmm. but I had been open up to all these new questions and new information. And I'd start to hear names like Thomas Aquinas. And there was a professor, an elderly professor, sort of from that older, fabulous, solid generation who was still teaching, Yaroslav Pelikan, who was teaching a course in medieval European intellectual history for the whole year. So I asked permission from the history department to switch and study that. So I spent that whole year studying from St. Augustine to Thomas Aquinas.
Wow.
I was like a child in a candy store.
Yeah.
And I had his lecture class. I had directed readings with him. He'd say, go read St. Augustine's Confessions, come back when you're done. Then he said, go read City of God, come back when you're done. And I'd talk with him one-on-one. I was taking Latin. And it just so happened that my Latin instructor was this amazing Russian Jewish man who was a Catholic convert. That I found that out later, and he came to my confirmation later. So that was fabulous. I started to go to daily mass and discovered, oh my gosh, there's a lot of the Bible here. Like, I can, the Catholic Church is a place I could actually learn about the Bible.
Right.
And something that I loved that I had never expected. Because I had first thought the saints thing was a little weird until Peter Kraft said, well, do you ask your friends to pray for you? So I can ask a saint to pray for me. Was before Mass, somebody would announce whose feast day it was and say just a few words about the saint. So every day I'm learning about these new, not just role models, but inspirations. And I'm finding like this saint's forte, their strong point is exactly not what I'm doing in my life. Like it's pulling me out of where I am to go somewhere. And I thought, this whole thing is designed for sinners. This is really great.
What a great way to put it.
And during that year, I started receiving instruction to come into the Catholic Church. I did not attend the RCIA program at the parish. This was in New Haven, Connecticut. Another graduate student and I got permission to get tutoring from a woman from Opus Dei. I was not in Opus Dei, but she made herself available to us as a resource, which was really generous of her time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So she instructed us all year until Easter Vigil. But
yes,
the day we went to the church to do the run through, and they showed us, would show us, and I think it must have been the Saturday morning, you know, you stand here, you do this. I had a huge crisis. I didn't tell anyone, but inside it was war. I can't do this. I'm not going to do this tonight. Catholic? Like, what about the things I don't understand? What about the things I don't know about? And Catholic? If I say yes to this, again, it's that question of my philosophy professor. Is this true? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm here to make a profession before God, my creator, the creator of all, that I think this is true. You know, when I discovered from my conversations with my friend in front of the abortion clinic, okay, Jesus didn't write a book, he founded a church.
Right.
And love for the book, the Word of God, is part of that.
Yeah.
But Jesus founded a church, he founded a community. And that made sense to me. But I ran into a brick wall in a way that it felt like I hit my head so hard that I was knocked out and wasn't going to go further. Like almost panic starts to set in. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And my sponsor, Kathy Deeds, had come up from Washington, D.C., and another friend had come up from Washington, D.C., but I thought, okay, that can't be the reason I make this decision today. I'm going to have to stand before God. How am I going to, what am I going to, can I say this is true? And two things got me over the finish line. One was a memory from the summer of 1988 when I was an intern in Bonn, Germany. Mm-hmm. I happened to remember that it was August 6th that year. Some friends and I took a bike ride and we rode our bikes from Bonn to Cologne along the beautiful bike path along the river. And in Cologne, we went to the Cologne Cathedral. And I was overcome with awe, love. That was one of the greatest moments in my life, getting to walk into and be in the Cologne Cathedral. And the others I was with were very Protestant. Like, weren't really sure about it. And I was like, how can you not be just swept away? And so it was that and the music of William Byrd, one of my favorite composers. He was an English composer who resisted the pressure of the Reformation, and his music is so beautiful that I just knew I had to be with whatever inspired that architect or those who designed the Cologne Cathedral and William Byrd. That's because it's true. And so that night then, I was confirmed at St. Mary's Church in New Haven at the Easter Vigil and became Catholic at Easter 1990.
Wow. Jennifer, what a journey. We have 5 minutes left, and I have so many more questions. I also know that a lot has happened since then. So with the 5 minutes that we have left, as best as you can, What happened after? What's some of the things that have happened since?
Studying Thomas Aquinas that year made me discover the Greek translations of Aristotle that went through Arabic. Mm-hmm. So I left medieval European history, studied Greek and Arabic, and studied the transmission of Greek philosophy and natural science and medicine into medieval Europe. Did my PhD in Greco-Arabic studies at Yale. I graduated in December 2000. And 10 months later, the attacks of 9/11 happened. There I was, unemployed with a PhD in Arabic and Islamic studies, wanting to work outside academia. I wanted to work for the military and defend my country, which not everybody from an academic background wanted to do.
Yeah.
So I worked for the military after 9/11. One of the deepest experiences I've ever had in my life is I spent 2 years as an interrogator at Guantanamo. At EWTN, Colm Flynn interviewed me about that experience. Mm-hmm. So that video is available for EWTN. I wrote about it once at Public Discourse and once at The Lamp, although it's not a topic that I'm like eager to be real public about, but I think it's important to talk about.
Sure.
And then after that, I worked at several think tanks, taught part-time at the Army War College, and currently today I translate Catholic authors. I feel like I can hopefully give something now to Catholics, and the Church have given so much to me. I translate Catholic authors from the early to mid 20th century from German to English, especially a woman named Ida Friederike Göres, who died in 1971, and other authors.
Wow.
As one you may have heard of named Joseph Ratzinger.
Yeah. You're also the, let's see, the fellow. Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Institute. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., which is often known by its initials, EPPC, is a think tank, and it's an alliance of conservative Catholics, evangelicals, and Orthodox Jews to have a role for people of faith in public policy in America.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. All right. Well, I guess one of the many, many burning questions, the only one I'll have time for, though, is just, you know, one of the fascinating things about your story, Jennifer, is like, you had such a questioning, truth-seeking mind, and gosh, in God's providential grace, right, at these key moments, he knew what you needed, right? Okay, so I'm not sure how to translate the question, but like, there are people out there with some of the similar questions, the similar concerns, the similar feelings. What is a word of encouragement you might offer to them?
Allow God to work in your life. Because when I try to fight against that, it never worked. Mm-hmm. But when God wants to show himself to us, let yourself learn, be open to God's love. God wants to share himself. And also that experience for me of that God loves us so much that God isn't just abstract, but wants to guide us through his church and has left the church for us. Has just been a really beautiful part of that whole experience.
Yeah. I think, too, of that youth pastor who invited those questions.
And planted seeds, I'm sure.
And then also the joy, the lived joy of those Polish Catholics that you met.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we can never underestimate not just the content. Sometimes I think we get too caught up when we think about evangelization with, oh, I need to have all the right answers, all the right words, when invite the questions, entertain the dialogue.
And the way Pastor Bill lived, spoke to, there was something different going on in his life. The way these Polish students lived. These Polish students would even stay up at night studying Marxism-Leninism to prepare for class in order to refute the arguments in class. They didn't have to. They could have been partying. They could have, you know, gone to sleep early. It was the way they lived. And the joy and the kindness, and they loved being Catholic. Mm-hmm. So it radiated in ways that wasn't spoken in words.
Yeah, well, that's so incredible. Thank you so much, Jennifer, for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for your continued work, you know, with the Institute and all that you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I love what you guys do.
Well, thank you for being part of it and sharing your story. And thank you for being here for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Jennifer's story is an inspiration to you. To continue the journey, right? As she said, right, being open to what God is doing in your life, never shying away from those questions, right? God speaks to us through the human nature that he has given to us as our creator. And so he speaks to us through these desires, these longings, this restlessness that will not be at rest until it rests in him. And so we never want to sort of, you know, ignore or push that down in ourselves or in other people. We want to invite those questions, trusting that God's grace is building on our human nature. And so let's continue the journey. Let's keep each other in prayer. We'll be back again next week with another story. In the meantime, God bless.